we can teach everybody a mantra. And somebody, there was a clinician that was just telling me, she reported back that she was teaching this to her patients with good effect. Mm-hmm. And the mantra was, Don't ask me how to spell it.
Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. My guest today is Dr. Judson Brewer. Judd is a psychiatrist, an associate professor of psychiatry at the School of Medicine at Brown University, and the director of research and innovation at Brown's Mindfulness Center. He's become an authority on the application of mindfulness in the treatment of anxiety, addictions, and eating disorders, and his work has been featured in some of the top medical and neuroscience journals, as well as in the popular media. His recent TED Talk is ranked the fourth most popular of 2019. Judd's research and clinical work are highly innovative, in part because of his insightful integration of traditional Buddhist psychology with modern neuroscience and psychology. In recent years, he's focused on making his work accessible to the general public and has produced online programs for helping people reduce anxiety, overeating, and smoking. He's also the author of The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits, one of my all-time favorite books on mindfulness. Our conversation covered Judd's theory that anxiety is actually just a bad mental habit, the reward-based learning model that explains the development of all habits and addictions, the role of the brain's default mode network in anxiety, why episodes of mental illnesses like anxiety tend to recur, and how mindfulness can help us unwind anxiety. If you'd like to learn how to practice mindfulness to help you with your anxiety or any other unhelpful habit, please reach out to Mindspace at mindspacewellbeing.com or on social media. And if you'd like to be up to date on the latest news on the Mindspace podcast, please sign up for our newsletter at mindspacewellbeing.com/newsletter. And without any further delay, here is my conversation with Judson Brewer. All right, I'm here with Judson Brewer. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm going to ask you a really quick question. You introduce yourself to me as Judd. I've heard you referred to as Dr. Judd, Dr. Brewer. How do we go with your name from here?
Judd works well.
Okay. All right. So again, thanks for coming. And this is really exciting for me. I'm a big fan of your work and have been accumulating questions over the years as I read your stuff and watch your TED Talks and this kind of thing. So I want to start with, you know, a little brief bio. What exactly are you up to these days and how did you arrive in that professional context?
I am the Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. I also founded a company that started out of Yale called Mind Sciences. So that's my day and my night job right now. And I arrived there in a long and winding road. Started meditating my first day of medical school and kind of got the bug and haven't stopped since. Shifted my entire research and even some of my clinical career from studying molecular biology to learning about how our minds work and helping people change behavior based on that. And it all started with the fundamental question of how the heck does my mind work? I had no idea. And I have a little bit more of an idea.
I do think one of the things that's very remarkable about your background and the kind of thing I love to explore on the podcast is just that you've done a deep dive in both a sort of traditional Buddhist perspective, like through the insight meditation approach and through your neuroscience. That must be a very cool set of perspectives to bring to the table. Do you find that you're leveraging both of those points of view, or is it you, when you're in the lab, you're a scientist, and when you're on retreat, you're a meditator?
Yeah, I have to say I was very fortunate to have not thought about doing any research on mindfulness for about a decade, because it helped me just focus on the experiential components, like what's going on, instead of thinking, oh, what's my mind doing now? Okay, how about this? So that piece was really instrumental in helping me develop a foundation of experience before even thinking about doing research. And as I trained to become an addiction psychiatrist, I was noticing that my patients were actually speaking a lot of the same language that the Buddhist psychologists were speaking. And I didn't think that was a coincidence, and so wanted to understand that more. And at the same time, was realizing that there were really significant limitations to the treatments that we had for addictions. I was really struggling to help my patients overcome all sorts of things, you know, from heroin to cocaine to alcohol, even to binge eating and anxiety, and really, you know, didn't feel like we were nailing it, at least from what I had been traditionally taught. So there was this confluence of conditions where these things came together, and I started really exploring how, you know, could these mindfulness practices actually apply to my clinical setting, and started researching, you know, did these things work clinically, and what's the underlying neurobiology, and you know, how can we train people to break, you know, break bad habits, so to speak.
Cool. So I want to start with a quick anecdote before we jump into the question here. So I'm a psychologist. I do lots of individual therapy in addition to teaching mindfulness-based programs. And a few months ago, I saw a client, middle-aged man, who had a very stressful life and developed an anxiety disorder. And I did an assessment with him. And he was about to, I think, go off on vacation or something. He wasn't going to be available for about a month. And we agreed that he would take this time off, and then we would get together when he got back to sort of pick up the actual treatment. So he came back about a month later, and he said, it's really nice to see you again, but I don't think I'm going to come back. I found this app called Unwinding Anxiety, and I think I get it now. And that had never happened before. There was an app, and this guy picked it up, and he learned the skills, and he was okay. And I thought, oh my God, I need to figure out what's going on here. And that's one of the reasons why I actually wanted to reach out to you. So Unwinding Anxiety is your app to help people deal with anxiety. And I really want to understand what you now understand about anxiety that helps you be so effective with that program. So let's start with the basics. What exactly is anxiety? What do we mean clinically when we use that word?
That's a good question. And, you know, we can look at basic dictionary definitions that often have to do with like fear of the future or worry. But clinically, what I see, you know, my patients is they have this feeling that's just really uncomfortable, unpleasant, hard to localize. There's restlessness, there's agitation, general dis-ease, and they often don't know where it's coming from. So it's different than something like stress, where there's generally a clear precipitant, like, oh, my boss wants something, you know, done by tomorrow, or I have a meeting, I have to give a presentation, or my to-do list is too long. So that's how I think of anxiety, you know, clinically, is just, you know, is that stuff that comes up that, you know, it has disease, it's restless and hard to pinpoint it. I have a lot of patients, you probably do as well, where they wake up in the morning and they're like, oh yeah, I'm just, you know, I wake up and I'm anxious. And then it goes from there.
Right. So of course, people become very preoccupied with like, well, what do I have? Am I worrying? Am I having panic attacks? Is it social anxiety or GAD or some form of OCD? And if I'm understanding the way you're talking about it, these are clusters of symptoms that reflect the kind of expression of the sort of underlying disease that you just described. Is that a fair statement?
Generally, I would say I was describing generalized anxiety. I think things like panic disorder have related things, but often, you know, it's interesting when you look at the definition of panic disorder, it's not actually about the panic attacks themselves. It's when we have enough that we start worrying about having those in the future, and that changes how we live our lives, where we start avoiding things or, you know, trying to do things to not have a panic attack. So I think there are different flavors like you're talking about, but they all share this common element of, you know, this dis-ease, whether it's OCD, where somebody feels the dis-ease when they haven't acted out a compulsion, or they're stuck in an obsession and they can't get out of it. Panic disorders I just talked about, and then the generalized anxiety, where it's just pervasive, and they're, you know, it's not associated with places or faces or you know, panic attacks.
Right. Can you, I know this is probably a big question, but maybe by way of summary, can you tell us what we know about what's happening in the brain and the body, or let's just say the nervous system, when people experience that disease? Sorry.
That is a big question.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I could rephrase this. Whereas let's talk about the pragmatic, there's some pragmatic elements there around anxiety. Because often, you know, somebody has anxiety, they just want to know what it is. And then because the undertone there is, oh, and if I know what it is, then I can fix it.
Right.
And which actually sets them into a spiral of worry and trying to fix and buying tons of books and, you know, listening to podcasts and whatnot. So here, it's an interesting story, because I hadn't actually, you know, from a clinical standpoint, anxiety is kind of bread and butter for psychiatry, in terms of it's one of the most common conditions that we see, some flavor of anxiety. But as an addiction psychiatrist, I really was focused on habit change and habit formation. And so started work with alcohol and cocaine use disorder, and then smoking. And it was actually through that discovery process that I learned something really interesting and pragmatic around anxiety. So I'm going to get to your question, but I'm going to give a little bit of background here. So, for example, we were trying to understand what the mechanisms were that drove smoking, and how they were perpetuated, and how mindfulness could actually affect it. And it turns out that there's this basic learning process called reinforcement learning, or reward-based learning, operant conditioning, a bunch of names for it, that drive behavior, whether it's smoking or overeating and whatnot. And basically, you know, let's use smoking as an example. Somebody sees a cue, like they see somebody else smoke, and then they smoke a cigarette, and then they get that nicotine rush, you know, the dopamine hit to their brain that says, do that again. So it gets reinforced. And they can also, so that's positive reinforcement. They also can get negatively reinforced, like if they're stressed out, and that's the trigger, and they smoke a cigarette, that's the behavior. And then the reward is that they feel less stressed out because they've just gotten this dopamine hit. So we were understanding, trying to understand this from a cognitive neuroscience perspective with smoking, and then realized that this actually applies to eating as well. We've done some studies with smoking and found that mindfulness training could actually target the specific reward-based learning mechanisms, got good efficacy, like 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment, and then went into eating, and we're seeing the same thing. And you can imagine, you know, we're stressed, we eat, we feel better, binge eat, those types of things. Same mechanism. We started developing app-based trainings for that, got like 40% reduction in craving-related eating. But it was then that I learned something really interesting. Two things. One was, we could see this convergent mechanism. So whether it was smoking or eating, mindfulness was actually targeting this reward-based learning mechanism. But the other piece that we were noticing that was really fascinating was that people were coming to me from our eating program and saying, you know, I eat because of anxiety. Can you develop a program for anxiety? And I said, well, I'll look into it. And it was, there's this whole literature showing that mechanistically, that worry in particular and anxiety can be driven in the very same negative reinforcement process that eating is perpetuated, that smoking is perpetuated, that any addiction is perpetuated. So it really just widened my understanding of how anxiety actually, you know, it manifests and is perpetuated. that there could actually be a learned and habitual component of anxiety totally blew my mind. But it also gave me a great amount of hope, because in psychiatry, we don't have very many medications that help anxiety. You know, the SSRIs and some of these medications can help some people. Benzodiazepines are generally, you know, the recommendations are not to use benzodiazepines for longer than 2 to 4 weeks for a number of reasons. And so there just weren't very many medication options. And so this opened up an avenue of exploration where we could really address this learned component that I had never even considered before. I never learned it in medical school or residency. But here was this literature that was actually fitting. And so there's the roundabout way to saying, you know, here's a piece of anxiety that manifests. If we think about it from a reward-based learning standpoint, you need a trigger. So anxiety itself, the feelings of anxiety, could be a trigger or fear or something like that. And then the habitual behavior is we worry or we try to figure something out or try to fix it. And then that reward comes with either avoiding the negative emotion in the first place because we're caught up in worry, or maybe occasionally we learn something and we're like, oh, there, maybe I can fix it. But the problem is when we don't come up with that solution, the worry itself is not very pleasant. So it feeds back into anxiety, and then we start worrying that we're worrying, and then we get into this death spiral, so to speak, or this, you know, go over the event horizon into the black hole of anxiety where it's just, you know, feeding on itself. So I don't know if that gets at your question physiologically, but from a cognitive neuroscience standpoint, it at least gives us a behavioral mechanism that we can start to look at. And then there are specific brain regions that we can look at as well that line up with these. But we can pause there.
Yeah, I do want to pause there, because when you presented that idea at a conference I was at, it really resonated with me. I just think it's a really powerful idea that anxiety is a habit. It is, in a way, an addiction. And it's very counterintuitive to people because it's incredibly unpleasant, and there isn't the same clear sort of reward. So if someone is smoking, whether it's the nicotine or whatever the addictive component is, it's very clear there's a nice sort of physiological or experiential moment where there's either some relief or some pleasant buzz or whatever. You can make the same case about eating. But to suggest to somebody that they're addicted to worrying or that they've developed a habit of worrying, it can be very counterintuitive. And I just love to unpack this, what you said. And if I'm getting it right, it's the notion that something happens, somebody gets stressed out or there's some kind of threat cue, and then they start to think about the future or think about trying to fix it. And the thinking itself provides the person with the hope or the possibility that might resolve whatever is going on, let's say, emotionally. And that possibility becomes the reward, and they just move into thinking every time there's some kind of threat. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think so. I think the analogy that just comes to mind is, you know, we're in trouble and our mind says, I'll save the day, But the reality is, it's kind of like playing the lottery, and we think, oh, maybe I could get rich if I play the lottery. And maybe we can get rich if we play the lottery. Maybe we can solve whatever our problem is. But the likelihood that the problem is going to be solved, for example, with anxiety, where there's this feeling that comes out of the blue, is kind of like playing the lottery. Occasionally, we'll figure something out, but it might not even be causally connected. It might, you know, we might feel a little bit better at the time, but then the next time we go and do it again, it doesn't actually fix it.
Well, and isn't there an important distinction between situations where we have control, where problem solving will actually resolve the problem, and situations that are out of our control, and thinking about it and investing more energy is sort of a waste and might create the illusion that we're solving the problem, but actually is not.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the critical distinctions between planning and worry. So, you know, we could plan the trip to the airport, you know, once and maybe double check it to make sure we haven't missed anything. But if we go and start redoing that over and over and then start worrying about, oh, is there going to be traffic, or, you know, maybe the taxi is going to be late, or, you know, maybe there's going to be a sudden snowstorm in June, you know, whatever. That doesn't count as planning. That counts as worrying. And it isn't going to actually help us get to the airport. So I agree with you. I think there's a critical distinction there. And some of that is looking to see, you know, is this useful? Is this right. not useful? So planning, useful. Worrying, does it actually help? We can ask ourselves.
Right, right. Okay. So again, the rewarding aspect of worry is the promise that we might be solving a problem. And we just keep going back to the well.
That and occasionally, well, one of the other hypotheses is that it helps us distract ourselves from the actual underlying emotion, if it's fear, say, or even anxiety.
Okay. So the distraction is just sort of a temporary relief of that unpleasant feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. So worry can distract us from a feeling of fear or dread or even of anxiety itself, because the worry feels like we're doing something, whereas anxiety just feels like we're completely out of control. It's doing us.
Okay. What about these metaphors that people use, or these models that people use, around saying that anxiety is the sort of activation chronically of the fight or flight system? Do you endorse that metaphor in this context?
I think there are some related elements, but if you look at fight or flight, it's adaptive, and it actually works at a time scale that's much faster than anxiety does. So if fight or flight were working at such a slow time scale as anxiety does, we'd all be dead, you know, because we wouldn't actually have fought or fleed or flight, whatever, yeah. taken flight. So there's a physiologic response that says, hey, bus coming, get out of the way. And we get out of the way, and then we have this wave of fear, panic, that comes afterwards, where emotionally we say, oh, crap, I almost died. They're very different and very dissociable. So the same physiology, you know, we can feel similar physiology, which may be why people are talking about this chronic fight or flight piece. But my sense is that the fight or flight does something, you know, in an adaptive way, which whereas we're bringing on other brain machinery.
The HPA axis?
Well, the HPA axis is part of this, but that actually, you know, that brings in this, you know, the whole cortisol and all of the adrenergic response and all of this. But if we look from a brain perspective, you know, there's this network of brain regions called the default mode network that has to do with self-referential processing. And that seems to be at play when we get caught up in perseveration or rumination. So when we get caught up in that element of, oh no, this could have happened to me, because the default mode network is involved in self-reference, which is very different than just the physiology of the being saying, hey, you know, clamp down on your blood vessels. You might, you know, in case you get attacked and your blood vessel gets ripped open, you know, there will be less bleeding. That's not a "this is about me" phenomenon. That's a, you know, let's just get stuff done piece. So I see them as somewhat, you know, they're of course related, and they can affect each other. You know, the feeling of the adrenergic response can lead somebody into anxiety. And if that happens chronically enough, you know, it's hard to, you know, even the thoughts of anxiety can trigger somebody to have an adrenergic response. But if we look at them from a purely physiologic standpoint, you know, you can have fight or flight and not be anxious at all.
Right. Okay. So you've got this model for understanding anxiety as it is driven by reward-based learning. And you bring mindfulness into the mix here to help people, as you say, unwind it. So how does that work exactly?
So it goes back to these elements that we've been talking about. The first piece is really helping people understand how their mind works. You know, because if they can understand that, then they can work with their minds. And in that sense, you know, they can start by really just understanding how the process gets perpetuated. So if they have a feeling of anxiety, they can start to map out how it triggers a worry response and how they get caught up in worry thinking. And then what the result of that is, which tends to not be, you know, like, oh, this is great. I want to do it some more. So they can just start to see how the elements that they're actually adding to it are leading to negative outcomes. Mm-hmm. And what that does is help their brain kind of recalibrate how rewarding that behavior, the worry behavior is itself, because that's what drives future behavior. Reward-based learning is based on reward, not on the behavior itself. So if it were just based on behavior, we'd say, oh, worry, stop worrying, which I'm sure many of our parents have, or spouses or whatever, have told us to do. Hey, you worry too much, stop worrying. Oh, thank you. You know, it doesn't work that way. We worry that we're worrying. It spirals out of control. But if we focus on the results or the reward and say, you know, that's not very rewarding, and see that very clearly, that's what mindfulness can then help us do. Once we've mapped this out, we can see, oh, this is not very rewarding, which then drives disenchantment with the process itself. And this is actually super clear in the early Buddhist teachings, where it's written in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha said, you know, it wasn't until I explored gratification to its end that knowledge and vision arose. And the way I interpret that is, he was really, really exploring reward-based learning. How rewarding is this behavior? And it's only when we see that this is, you know, there's no juice left in this fruit, that we become disenchanted with the behavior. And that then starts to have us look for other things. Yeah. I think of this as looking for the BBO, the bigger, better offer. So we first have to see how this isn't serving us. And we learn that by seeing how our minds work. And then our brain starts looking for something better. And this is where we can bring in mindfulness practices themselves. And I love the, you know, that if you think of the second factor of awakening, Dhammavicaya, as interest or curiosity, what feels better, you know, fear, anxiety, panic, or curiosity? You know, it's a no-brainer, I guess, to our brains. And I see this in my patients with addictions as well. You know, curiosity feels much better than craving. So when we can then train them to just be curious about what the feelings of anxiety feel like in their direct experience, they can start to realize a number of things. One, these are just feelings. These are just thoughts, as compared to being identified with these things. Two, they can see that these don't last forever. And this is challenging, because a lot of folks with anxiety really feel it all throughout the day. And they say, well, my anxiety does last forever. And I say, well, let's explore that. Does it get stronger? Does it get weaker? Is there worry that feeds it? You know, there are lots of ways to explore the impermanent nature of the feelings. And also ways to explore how we resist the feelings of anxiety itself, how we, you know, we can change our relationship to it, and just hold that the feelings, these physical feelings, these emotional, the emotions, the physical sensations, we can hold those in our awareness. We can hold them with kindness and curiosity. And that holding, where we're providing that holding environment rather than pushing away or trying to do something, helps us move into a completely different relationship. And I've had a number of folks report back, you know, remember one person who, you know, said that she was really blown away by the curiosity, because when she really trained herself to bring curiosity to the fore when she was having panic, she could, curiosity just felt better, and she could notice that these were just feelings rather than, you know, something that she was so identified with. And it really helped her just be with panic attacks and really unwind from that, which helped that whole process itself unwind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. And I want to keep going with that. But first, I want to clarify something. I'm a little confused because at first we talked about how anxiety or worry can be rewarding. That's what sort of drives the formation of the habit.
Mm-hmm.
But then as, you know, someone using your app or someone bringing this approach to getting over their anxiety, they learn that it's not actually rewarding. So what's the distinction there?
So great question. So there are a couple of pieces here that they can start to unpack. One is, you know, when they look at the rewarding aspects of worry, how good does it actually feel to worry when they, in their direct experience, they've just thought of worry as, well, I'm going to fix this. And it might be kind of, you know, it might feel a little uncomfortable, but I'm doing something. Mm-hmm. So they can unpack the direct experience of what it actually feels like to worry as compared to, you know, I don't know anything else besides this. So I'm just going to do this and I'm going to keep doing it. And it feels like the right, you know, the only thing to do. So in one sense, it gets reinforced because, you know, it feels like they're in control. But the direct experience of quote unquote being in control can be explored and they can see, well, how rewarding is this actually? It doesn't feel that good. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So on an experiential level, it's not very rewarding or it doesn't feel good, but that doesn't change the fact that on a physiological level, the sort of temporary relief, whether it's by a distraction or the sense that they're getting something done, might be reinforcing the behavior. And then if I'm understanding, you're introducing an alternative way that has less experiential downside. Are you with me on that summary?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think an analogy here is, you know, I have a lot of my addiction patients who are working with cocaine dependence. And, you know, when they first started using cocaine, it was pretty rewarding.
Right.
But now they're just trying to get back to zero. And so they're kind of using it to catch up. And I think the same is true with worry. You know, at the beginning, it seems like it's a good idea to our brains because, you know, we're planning, we're getting in there doing something. But we don't realize that it doesn't actually help fix the problems. It actually just makes things worse. But we haven't noticed that.
Right.
So if that, I am agreeing with you.
Yeah. So that's a really nice nuance. And I want to come back to where we were a moment ago before I asked for the clarification and talk about this new way. So you talk about bringing curiosity and being with this unpleasant experience in a new way. When you start to pay attention to your experience, there are some kinds of experiences that are contracting in their energy and some kinds of experiences that are expanding. And maybe you can just pick it up from there and how you paying attention to that quality of experience can really drive a new kind of reward-based learning to get over anxiety.
Yeah, this is really live for me right now. My lab was just meeting because we're trying to work out an operational definition of this, you know, kind of this somatic state,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't seem, you know, there's some concepts in the literature that seem to line up, but the experiential component is so clear. We see this over and over and over again. We want to have this be something that we can really really explore in a more fine-grained way. So the way we're thinking about this is this open and closed dichotomy. This is related to the emotional feeling of contraction or expansion and contraction. And it relates the somatic experience to the emotional, you know, the emotional feeling. So for example, if somebody is afraid, that would fall into the category of closed or contracted, which makes sense because, you know, if we're being chased, we want to make ourselves as small a target as possible for whatever's chasing us. And the opposite of that would be something like joy, where we feel this joy or love or connection, where we're feeling this expanded, more connected quality with the world or with somebody else. So experientially, I think we all know what these states feel like. And from a reinforcement learning standpoint, we can start to look to see how they can help us change behavior. Because our brains are, as I mentioned, our brains are looking, they're always looking for something more rewarding. So if I asked you, and I think you have a pretty clear sense for this now, right? Closed versus open. What feels better, closed or open?
Yeah, obviously open feels better. I'm going to let you keep going because I have another question about why I sometimes choose closed, even though open feels better. But let's go back to your what you were saying.
Yeah, so we'll put a pin in that. We'll come right back to that. So from a reward-based learning standpoint, we can actually start to look to see experientially, are people moving from closed to open? And does that correlate with improved outcomes? And the theory would be that just simply bringing awareness in to how painful closed feels compared to how less painful open feels, just helping them see those states clearly and helping them see the cause and effect relationship between behavior and result, they would naturally move from closed to open. So let's use a concrete example to kind of cement this. You know, if somebody is being mean to somebody else and they notice, they pay attention and notice that that person is suffering, they might feel closed because they feel a little bad about what they just did. And then they can compare that to when they were kind to that person and notice that that feels, it feels better. We'd rather have, you know, I'd rather live my life with people being kind. And certainly would rather be kind to people than being mean. And so we can see that you know, there's a natural propensity to move in that direction with awareness when we see how painful being a jerk is compared to being nice.
Right. So I do want to jump in with an example about anxiety in the sense that, as you indicated earlier, when someone is worrying, it tends to be a closed or a constricted sense. And it's like not open to new ideas, not open to different ways of dealing with what's going on. It's painful. It's uncomfortable versus bringing a more of a mindful awareness to that experience. There's curiosity, there's openness, there's interest, and that is more expansive.
Yes.
And isn't it the case that that expansive feeling becomes the new reward?
Absolutely. So that's the magic. I hesitate to say magic because this isn't like Matt waving a wand, but I would say this is the beauty of the simplicity of these practices. And I think, and we've written about this, I think that the Buddha actually described reward-based learning way before paper was even invented. And what he was highlighting were these, you know, these qualities of experience that just feel better. And so we're going to naturally, they're more rewarding. So curiosity is more rewarding, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's it. And that's, it's not that we have to change anything. It's not that we have to do anything. But all we really need is to simply bring awareness and help our brains link up cause and effect. Right. Cause and effect. And with anxiety, oh, when I'm anxious, the effect is I'm more, when I'm worried, I get more anxious. Oh, when I'm curious and simply hold my, you know, bring awareness to the physical sensations, to the thoughts, I can start to see that these are just thoughts, these are just physical sensations. And that already changes my relationship. I'm less identified and that feels better. And so we just rinse and repeat. We do it over and over.
Right. So I love the fact that you talked about magic because it does raise the question. And believe me, I've been through this loop many, many times myself. If it was in a way sort of that magical where you just link up cause and effect and the expansive quality of mindfulness and curiosity and openness is so much better and so much more rewarding, why does it take so long to get back to a point where anxiety is no longer, you know, overwhelming for people? And why do people slide back into anxious episodes? Shouldn't it just stick?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think there are a couple of elements that may be at play here. One is that we don't see the cause and effect super clearly at the beginning. So it's hard for people to link this up sometimes, you know, right at the beginning, mm-hmm. where they, you know, they're like, well, was that really it or was it something else? And so there's a lot of noise in the system. And it's hard to get a clear sense for, oh, was that it or was something else it? And so they have to repeat that over and over and over. And you know, in science, when we repeat an experiment, it separates out the signal from the noise. And so we get a, you know, a bigger signal to noise ratio, and we can say, oh, that's significant. That's real. Sometimes in our own experience, we can have, you know, huge experiences where we say, wow, that was clearly linked to this. I don't need to repeat that 1,000 times. But with anxiety, when there's been so much reinforcement of the system, it's hard to really get a clear sense of, oh, was that an anomaly or was that real? And so we have to repeat it over and over. So that's one piece. The second piece is the amount of time that we've repeated the behavior and become so identified with it. It's like we've dug this deep ditch or this deep groove, and we climb out, and it's just so easy to just fall right back into it, just habitually, because that's how our brains work, is that they learn something and they say, okay, I got this. I'm going to free up your, you know, brain space. I'm going to free up this memories and learning process so I can learn other things. And so they just go along habitually being anxious, for example, or worrying. So it's really hard to, so to speak, convince our brains to really pay attention, because they say, dude, why would I change this? I've been doing this for 30 years. You know, why change now? So I think there are several of those at play that make it, you know, make it challenging for folks to change behavior. There's one third element that might even be more challenging, which is this whole thing about being identified with our thoughts and identified with our emotions. That gets reified anytime we look in the mirror. Well, you know, I shouldn't say it that way, but for, you know, that can get, that's a pretty sticky thing. Mm-hmm. And to even imagine, which isn't going to move us very far because we have to directly experience this, but to even get us to the place where we can start to explore, oh, I am not my thoughts. I am not these sensations. And to even know what it feels like to be aware of as compared to be identified with can be really challenging for some people. And so that can take a long time to really just get a handle on, oh, this is what they're talking about in terms of, you know, having awareness of a sensation rather than being identified with.
Right. So this is a really interesting point of conversation, because there's no question in my mind anyway that we are now moving towards Dharma territory. And of course, this has been more and more recontextualized into mainstream psychology and the mindfulness framework. But we're really now touching on the no self teaching. And I know in sort of navigating this territory with my clients, this can be very destabilizing. So like, what do you mean I'm not my thoughts? What do you mean I'm having a craving and that's not me? And you even had this, you know, sort of funny language. You're like, oh, well, dude, stop doing that. Like, as if we have a conversation with something.
yeah.
Like, how do you navigate this in a way that doesn't suddenly make you seem like an esoteric spiritual guru?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think this is a really important one, because sometimes we can inadvertently kind of go down the road of, you know, well, I'm going to explain this intellectually, because we're actually hiding from the direct experience because we can't explain it well.
Right.
So here it's really important. This is a great way to kind of keep us honest in terms of, do we actually understand what we're talking about experientially? I don't remember if it was, I think it was Joseph Goldstein that described this simple way of exploring this, which is, am I taking something personally? And that can kind of help with the existential threat of, you know, right. What do you mean? I don't exist. Of course I do. I just drank that tea or whatever. That's not actually the problem. Drinking tea is not a problem. Somebody drinking tea. The problem is when we take things too personally. And so that's something that I find much more accessible for people, is to ask, you know, well, what's it like when you take something personally? I think most folks can relate to that. You know, a simple example would be, so, you know, somebody saying, well, that's a dumb idea. And we're like, what? I thought it was a great idea. Oh, oh, I was attached to that view. So I took that suggestion personally. And there's a contraction around that. There's a closed downness. There's a protection. And we can look inward and just say, oh, that's what that feels like, to be contracted. So on a very pragmatic and experiential level, we all know what it's like to take something personally. And in the same way, we can start to explore our experience of anxiety, for example, and see, are we taking that personally? So if, for example, when I have, you know, I've had panic attacks before at residency training. I don't know what it says about our medical training, but anyway, that's where I tended to get panic attacks. And, you know, it was like, wow, do I worry about, you know, I'm having a panic attack, versus do I just bring awareness in and notice the physical sensations and notice, you know, that it feels like, literally it felt like I was going to die. You know, my breath, you know, breathing was really short. My heart was racing, and I literally, just like the textbooks, got this tunnel vision. At the time, you know, I'd been practicing about 10 years, so I was really fortunate. I was doing a bunch of noting practice at the time. So I would just note I was like, oh, heart racing. Oh, can't breathe. Oh, tunnel vision. And there was this curious awareness that could observe all the sensations that would happen. And then I was training to be a psychiatrist. So after the panic attack went away, my brain would, I'd often wake up from sleep with these. So my brain would say, oh, check, 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 check. Oh, you just had a panic attack. And then I would go back to sleep, because it wasn't like, oh no, I just had a panic attack. It was, oh. So that, oh no, is taking something personally. The oh is a curious awareness, and that helps keep it clean. Like, oh, here is it. Here was something that happened. Go back to sleep. You know, it's over. Go back to sleep. And I could.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm with you on this, that sort of curious awareness. It really takes the sting, you know, not taking things personally really takes the sting out of these things. But if you are not your heart racing, if you are not your mind racing about your imminent death, if you are not the shakes because of withdrawal or some craving or something, then what are you?
Do you want to go there?
Yeah, I kind of do. I'm just curious to know how you would address that, you know, in concrete language. Like,
okay,
many clients end up with this sort of discomfort, as did I at certain points.
Yeah, yeah. So let's go there, and then we're going to come back to pragmatics, because from a pragmatic standpoint, with my patients, I don't often find that it's helpful to go there.
Right, right.
And so they say, what do you mean? You know, this isn't me. And I stay at the level of, you know, taking things personally, because, and that generally, you know, people are generally satisfied with that. If they want to go deeper, we can go a little deeper. And so that's what, let's do that now. But then we'll bring it back to the pragmatics, because I tend to, you know, you get this as a clinician. It's like, well, what's really helpful here? We could have a great intellectual discussion, and, you know, how is this going to help people? So we'll make sure we always tie it back there. So going there, if you think of reward-based learning, it's interesting. We wrote a paper about this a couple of years ago, where I worked with a Pauli scholar, Jake Davis, and explored dependent origination, these 12 links of dependent origination, and found this pattern that was just absolutely so lock in step with reward-based learning. And I said, this cannot be a coincidence. And so we explored this, and it really looks like, you know, as I mentioned, that the Buddha discovered this before paper was invented, that dependent origination was really describing operant conditioning or reward-based learning. And if you look at dependent origination, it talks about the details of the 12 links aren't as important for this discussion as one element, which is, you know, we have this craving, so tana. So we have this craving and then this becoming, where we kind of form a sense of self based on our previous behavior, based on our actions. And that becomes reified every time we do that. So for example, if I, you know, let's use anxiety because we're going with that one. If I feel a feeling and then I associate that with the thought, oh, I'm anxious, then that gets reified to the point where we wake up in the morning and the first thing we look around for is, you know, our body sensations. And then our brain's like, oh yeah, you're anxious. And then it's like, boom, those sensations come up, you know, again, and suddenly we're like, wow, I just woke up and I'm anxious and I don't know what it was. These habits get formed around the reification of a sense of self. And so if we, you know, the more we live certain experiences and the more we reinforce them, the more we become identified with them to the point where they, you know, they define who we are. So we've certainly, you know, met people like, oh, that guy's an anxious dude, or that person's, you know, he's angry. You know, he's angry all the time. Well, the more we do that, the more we become identified with those things. So bringing this back to the sense of self, we can think of the sense of self just being reified through habits. And I love, see if I get this right. There's a quote from Alan Watts. I'm sure you know who Alan Watts is, this philosopher, brilliant guy. And he said, the ego, the self which he has believed himself to be, is nothing but a pattern of habits. And so if somebody says, what do you mean no self? We can look at the, you know, we can look at, well, who do we think we are? And, you know, if I ask myself, who am I? Well, I look in the mirror and it's like, you know, I'm a man and I'm a, you know, I'm a scientist. Well, you know, that idea of scientist or that idea of psychiatrist is, you know, it's like I reify that every time I say, yep, that's me. And so we can start to unpack that and say, well, in this moment, what is that? Well, it's just kind of the updating of memory from the previous moment. And then, from, you know, that feeds into the future. So we get the sense of self that seems like it's continuous over time, that is just kind of an update. You know, it's like a, oh yeah, that's who I am. That's who I am. Like an updating or remembering based on our previous experience. And so if we take that premise, we can actually say, okay, if that's true, what happens if I forget about the past? What happens if I let go of the future? Well, there's just being. And so it's not that I'm not being, but the sense of self of I am this might just, you know, rest as a potential in the moment when it's not being reified. And I'm just simply resting in awareness. And I think this is where these concepts of flow come in. You know, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi described this aspect of flow using terms like selfless, timeless, effortless. So if you bring it back to the contraction piece, that contraction that says, oh yeah, I'm a psychiatrist. You know, you say that I'm a bad psychiatrist. There's me being identified with that idea. That reification says, you know, this contraction says, yes, that's me. Well, when we start to let go of that and expand and expand and expand, we start to lose a sense of who we are experientially, because we lose that boundary between the self and the rest of the universe. And then we move into flow, which is completely selfless, yet it's an experience that's happening. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I didn't lose you at that point.
Absolutely not. I'm fully with you. And I feel like this is an irresistible opportunity to move into talking about the default mode network, because what I'm understanding is that it's this self-reflection that, if I'm understanding correctly, mm-hmm. is sort of mediated by or driven by the default mode network. The self-reflection on, oh, this is me now, and oh, this is me now, and oh, this is me now. We sort of construct the sense of self by this ongoing story about who we see ourselves as each moment, right?
Yes.
And so I'd love to hear you talk about, you know, how mindfulness sort of helps, I don't know, decommission the default mode network, at least temporarily, and make us maybe a little less dependent on it or reliant on it on a day-to-day basis. How would you frame that?
Yeah. So let's just start with a clarification to make sure we're on the same page. With the default mode network, there are two main hubs. One's the medial prefrontal cortex, one's the posterior cingulate cortex, and they talk to each other all the time. The hypothesis is that the medial prefrontal cortex is more the conceptual sense of self, and a conceptual sense of self is not a problem. It's taking that conceptual sense of self too personally, where, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, I'm a psychiatrist. Somebody says, you're a bad psychiatrist. <You know? laughs> And so there's that contraction around, oh, no, but I'm a good psychiatrist, that lets me know that's who I, you know, that's me. So the contraction piece is what I think of as the experiential sense of self. And that seems to be most readily identified, or the most readily, at least what we've studied the most, is the neural correlate around the posterior cingulate cortex. And so we've used some neurophenomenologic techniques where we can actually line up people's direct subjective experience with their posterior cingulate activity. And it seems not to be related to people having thoughts, but it's when they get identified with or take those thoughts personally, or even emotions as well. So the posterior cingulate seems to be this marker of the experiential sense of self. And it's oversimplified. I'm sure there are other brain regions and networks involved, but that's just the one that we've zoomed in on as a marker. And so every time somebody, you know, does something that threatens our existence, that contraction says, there you are. And it gets reified. So I'm just lining up what you just said with mm-hmm. where we're going to go next. Mm-hmm. So where mindfulness comes in is it helps with two things. So if we bring in the reinforcement learning process, we can say, well, how does it feel when you take something personally? Oh, I love getting contracted. You know? Mm-hmm. I love fuming and plotting revenge and thinking how I'm going to get that guy the next time. No, it doesn't work that way. It's a pain. It's painful. It's a painful process. So we can bring awareness in and say, you know, how's that going for you, taking things personally? Not in a, you know, I told you so way, but in a curious way. Oh, wow, not so good, is it? You know, it looks like you're pretty anxious. So we can start to see the lack of reward in that, which then helps us bring awareness to the next piece, which is that awareness itself can feel better than being identified with ourselves. So that kind, curious awareness itself feels better. And so when we're caught up in anxiety, we just bring in that awareness and get curious. Oh, what's anxiety feel like? So for example, in our Unwinding Anxiety program, on day one, we kind of walk people into the ability and the idea that they have this inherent capability of being curious by saying, okay, you're anxious, let's go there. Where does it, you know, so check in your body to see where you feel anxiety most strongly. And now tell me, is it stronger on the right side or the left side? And they have to go, is it on the right side, more on the right side or the left side? Now, what does do? It opens us to curiosity. Oh, I don't know. And the answer is it doesn't matter what side it's on. But what matters is they just touched into their inherent capacity to be curious right on day one. And then they can just go from there. So even that, we can take it, we can bring this kind, curious awareness even to the worst of anything and start to just, you know, crack that nut a little bit with this inherent capacity that we have. And it feels better. It's not like anxiety vanishes, but it helps us see, oh, I can actually be with this, which is better than running away from it. I can actually expand a little bit with this injection of curiosity rather than contracting down and down and down, thinking, oh, this anxiety is never going to end. Oh, this is terrible. This is awful.
Yeah, that's really good. I know that we're sort of coming up on an hour here. We got to wrap this up. If it's okay with you, maybe one last question.
Sure.
We understand more and more that a lot of these disorders, addictions, anxiety, mood disorders, eating disorders, in many cases, these are not one-off experiences. These are, some people say, like sort of chronic illnesses with recurring episodes. So how do you think about this process of like always having to rediscover this new way of relating to difficult experience, having to reconnect the causal chain or sort of rediscover the causal chain? And, you know, maybe what advice you would have on a pragmatic level for people who have been dealing with this on a more chronic basis?
So this is a great question, and I'm going to give maybe a little bit of a controversial answer, but I'm happy to do this because I think we've seen this enough and it fits with the theories that I'm happy to go out on a limb and also happy not to be attached to it if it's wrong. So where these might be chronic is that we're not actually getting at the heart of the problem, the root of the problem. Let's use an analogy. So for example, when you were a kid and your parents, convinced, I don't know if you were a kid when, and your parents convinced you that Santa Claus was real, but we can all think back to that time where, you know, it's like the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus or whatever is real. And, you know, we're growing up and we're thinking, is that guy really real? You know, I don't know. Well, and then eventually we go to the mall, you know, and it's Christmas and, you know, we're getting on Santa Claus's lap and we reach for the beard and you can see the fear in our parents' eyes. Cause it's like, no, cause as soon as we pull down on that beard, it's game over. Mm-hmm. You can't pretend that you didn't see that. So is the Santa Claus problem chronic? No, it's when we see clearly, we can't go back. And that's what we see over and over and over with mindfulness. We see this in our eating program. We see this in our anxiety program, is that over time, as people see this more and more clearly, they can't unsee it. So I think people fall back to habitual behaviors when they forget. But as they deepen their wisdom through seeing things more and more clearly, they slip less. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't fall back, because you can't fall back unless you've completely forgotten something. And some of these things, you know, the Santa Claus thing, you just can't undo that.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes a question of keeping that insight top of mind or staying connected to it experientially. And as soon as that sort of flips and you have that clarity, that personalization of these thoughts and feelings and stuff kind of just dissipates very quickly and you're back to ordinary experience that has sometimes some joy and sometimes some pain, but you're just living it through.
It does. And we've started incorporating these mental simulation exercises into our eating program, for example, to help people, like if they're about to eat a food, they can just imagine what it's like to eat it. And the idea is to help bring up their memory of what was it like to eat it last time, because mental simulations are based on previous experience. And if they get a stronger craving, that suggests that they're not that disenchanted. And it can really help them say, okay, let me pay attention as I do this. And then as they eat it and they're like, wow, that was not that good. That memory gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So this type of thing can help us simulate, you know, how disenchanted are we? We even see this in the suttas where the Buddha was teaching his son Rahula. You know, he says, reflect on what you're about to do. And if you can't reflect on it before you do it while you're doing it. And if you can't do that, reflect on it afterwards. That's all related to reward-based learning and helping us really see the rewards or lack thereof of our behavior. And if we can't remember, well, the good news is we can just do it again. And if we pay attention when we're doing it, our brain's like, oh yeah, that was, I forgot, that was not that good. Mm-hmm. So it's whether it's a matter of having a Santa Claus moment where we have a really strong experience or just slowly chipping away at it over time, we're all gonna progress at our own rate. But as long as we're bringing awareness and an attitude of curiosity each moment, there's no such thing as falling back. Because if you've learned something, mm-hmm. Does that count as falling back? No, you've learned something, you've moved forward. So it actually kind of redefines, you know, is there such a, or calls into question, I would put, calls into question two steps forward, one step backwards. I would say there are no steps backward if we're paying attention and we're willing to learn from everything that we do. And then it's just a matter of time, rinse and repeat.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. I think that was really well said. I guess we'll have to wait for some data on that hypothesis. It certainly sounds plausible.
Well, we just finished a study with anxious physicians with our unwinding anxiety program. We got a 57% reduction in clinically validated anxiety scores.
Wow.
With them. I was pleased to see that.
Yeah.
And we've gotten pretty good results with our eating program, 40% reduction in craving related eating. And we just finished a study that we published with our smoking program where we linked up these exact mechanisms with the brain mechanisms, where we saw that a reduction in posterior cingulate activity after mindfulness training, but not the control group, predicted reductions in smoking. So we're seeing pretty good results with our app-based trainings. And I think, this is also where clinicians can be working with this stuff with their patients and exploring, helping them understand how their minds work as a place to start, and then bring awareness with these, into their daily lives using these very, very simple principles. Not that it's easy, but really understanding these simple principles can help, quite a bit, I think, in the clinic.
Right. Maybe you can just tell people where they can get their hands on these three apps. First of all, what they're called, where to get them, and then also where they might find ways to keep up to date with what you're up to these days.
Oh, sure. So I have a completely self-referential website called drjud.com, drjud.com, which is a resource website, which has a bunch of, animations, talks, our papers and all this stuff. All of that's, people can access that just to learn things about like what we talked about on this podcast. We also just put together a free web-based training series for healthcare providers where they can learn, these are 20-minute videos that they can watch. They can even get CME credits through Brown University, and really just unpacks, how habits are formed, what the evidence is behind mindfulness. There's even a couple of modules on clinician burnout and resilience, and even one on cell phone addiction. So that's available through the website, and folks can also learn about the apps that way. So the smoking app is called Craving to Quit. The eating app is called Eat Right Now. And the anxiety program is called Unwinding Anxiety. And there's links to all of those on the Dr. Judd website as well. So folks can take a look at that resource website and hopefully they'll find something useful there.
I have no doubt that they will. Dr. Judd, is there anything else that you think we definitely need to cover before we wrap this up?
How about this? We can teach everybody a mantra. And there was a clinician that was just telling me, she reported back that she was teaching this to her patients with good effect. Uh-huh. And the mantra was, don't ask me how to spell it. But experientially, what it does is helps us tap into this openness that we, and this curiosity that we all have. So folks can explore that mantra themselves, and they can explore using that with their patients. And I hope that it's helpful in reducing some of the suffering in this world.
My understanding is that in some meditation traditions, a mantra is a very expensive thing. and one has to invest. I feel like you might have just landed on a really interesting business idea. I might even turn that into a little audio clip and make it a social media meme, or try to anyway. That was super cool. I really appreciate that little bonus moment there. Thanks again for doing this, Judd. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing more of the amazing stuff that you're doing.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.